Today's presenter is Zygmunt Zulkowski. He has 4 years' experience in ZOS, web server, and HTTP server technical support. He has 14 years' experience in ZOS as a systems programmer with a Fortune 100 company in the North Jersey metro New York area. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Zygmunt.
Good day, everyone. My name is Zygmunt Zulkowski, and I'll be going over ZOS HTTP server performance tuning and troubleshooting. But before I move on, I'd like to say that don't confuse this product with the IBM HTTP server for WebSphere that comes available with WebSphere 6.1 and up. These are two different products. What I'm covering today is the IBM IHS, or the old Domino web server that comes with ZOS. Now, there will be pitch later on next year for the Apache server, and I just want to make that clear. Okay, we can move on to slide number two, please. Okay, the agenda for this presentation will be exploring standalone and scalable server, timers, persistent and non-persistent connection, how to run executables, caching, monitoring the server, and some tracing and troubleshooting. All right, before we move on to slide number three, I want to talk a little bit about max active threads, because before we can go into standalone and scalable servers, we have to understand, a basic understanding of how it works. Okay, and there's a directive in the HTTP.conf file called max active thread, and this directive sets the maximum number of threads that you want to have active at one time. Once the max is reached, the server holds new requests until another request finished and the threads become available. Slide number three, please. This comes up in our discussion on scalable HTTP server. So why would we want to have a scalable HTTP server? Well, the benefits are that we can use WOM, workload management, to spread the work around. We can also use scalable servers to isolate certain type of workload using Apple EMV directive in the conf file. WOM will start additional queue servers as per defined policies you have defined in your conf file. The important thing to note here, if you have both SSL mode and normal mode on, an initially scalable mode thread set will be set evenly between SSL and normal mode. With the queue server, you'll get some benefit of benefits for you in that area with the way the workload balancing is done. Slide number four, please. Okay, the disadvantage of having a scalable server, the disadvantage is that you have two or more workspaces, depending on how, because you're going to have a queue manager and a queue server. The other disadvantage you're going to have is a long coding path. And the other disadvantage is an extra work for install and extra work for troubleshooting. Because on a standalone model, without scalable, you're going to have one worker thread and one socket, and you could fall in the logs, which I'll be talking about in the tracing part, quite easily. But when you have scalable, that kind of change. What happens is that you now will be following the socket and not so much the worker thread. Slide number five, please. Okay, so the question is, the scale or not the scale? Well, we recommend to use a standalone server unless you want to isolate work or use dynamic scaling. It's critical. And you can do this with WOM transaction classification to manage and perform your enclave directives. Slide number six. Okay, is there a way to scale a standalone server? Yes, there is. There are several options here. One of them, we can set up port sharing option with TCP/IP port statement. This will allow you to have more than one standalone web server reading each request from the same port. TCP/IP will select and listen to the selected number of connections, both active and in the backlog, and at the time the incoming connection request is received. The other option is use the sysplex distributed to spread requests from multiple standalone servers. And the last option is use asynchronous sockets. Slide number seven, please. Okay. Asynchronous sockets was introduced in April 2004. What is asynchronous sockets? It is a socket that allows the client to connect and to maintain work without tying up the worker thread, using worker thread. There is a white paper, and it was introduced with APAR PQ86769, And later on in the presentation, I'll be giving the link for the white paper. Okay, for each worker thread would be selected for a client request socket from the pool and from the running of the request. Remember, with a standalone server, you have one thread, worker thread, and one socket to go with it. With asynchronous sockets enabled, what you will have is when your thread is waiting for work for someone else, the socket will pick up work for another thread. So it's picking up threads from the pool. Once the completion task is requested, the connection should persist, but the working thread will be placed back into the socket, back into the pool to select other pieces of work. Now, what's important here is that the amount of sockets will be depending on what you had defined on that socket second in your AF underscore INI file in your TCPIP. Slide number 8, please. Okay. To set up asynchronous sockets, you would do asynchronous sockets equals yes, or asynchronous sockets yes in your comp file. There would be no Apple EMV directive. You would add a dash NS, any string, to your ICS PARM and JCL for your server. The only restriction here is that you don't want your name to start with sys. And asynchronous sockets is the default with scalable servers. Slide number 9, please. Slide number 9 is the APAR number, PQH6769, and also the URL for the white paper. Slide number 10. Okay, the next set of things we'll be talking about are the timers. And with HP Server, there are 4 timers. There is an input timer, an output timer, a persistent timeout, and also a max persistent request timer. Now, what's important here that, you know, back in the early days in 2000 and 2002, you had HP Server, and that was pretty much the only timers you had. We all dealt with 14.4 modems, and so those timers are very important. Now, our environment, our world got a little bit more complex, because now we're hooking up these HP servers on the other side of the firewall, connecting them with the plugin to WebSphere or any other J2E server. Well, that comes in play with different timers. Now we have timers for the plugin, and we also have timers for WebSphere. The timers for the plugin will be server IO timer and connection timeout. And for WebSphere, the timer is the connection response timeout and the connection keep alive timeout. So where it gets confusing is that we don't want our timers to pop on the plugin or WebSphere, the J2 server, before our web server timer pop. So a good rule of thumb is to tier them up. So you want to have your plugin timers set a little bit higher than your web server timer, and you want your J2E timers for your application server set a little higher than your plugin. Otherwise, it can get confusing. Alright, now we're going to talk about the input timer. Okay, the input timer specified the time allowed for the client to spend a request. Now, this used to be important, like I said, back in 2000 when we had, you know, slow modem 14.4 or 9.6, and you could have a possible denial service where we kept the connection open for a long time. But currently, now with the way the Internet is involved with high-speed DSL and cable, I don't think that setting this timer very high is very, it's kind of like, it's recommended 3 seconds, very good here, and it can be tuned towards your specifications. When in the tracing, you'll see the word pop, open parenthesis 1, close parenthesis in the tracing. The current default is 30 seconds, and we recommend 3. And again, the current default 30 seconds was before, like I said in the past, it was, you know, you had slow modem, slow connections. And when the timer pops, the socket is closed, and the worker thread returns back to the pool. Slide number 11, please. The next timer is the output timer. And this specifies the max times of sending the output to the client. As the request has been completed and read, the request runs under this timer for the duration of the request. The only exception in this case is for a CGI. where the output timer will be turned off and the duration request will run under a script timer. The recommended setting is the server is 10 seconds, but it all depends on the way you have, if you're using SAS, GGI, or GWAPI. In the tracing, if you want to know if that timer popped, it'll be popped with open friend to close friend. Action taken when the timer is popped, SOC is closed. The request is allowed to continue to work, although the response will never return to the client. And the worker thread will return to work only when the work is completed. Slide 12, please. Okay, the script timeout. Specify the time allowed for a CGI program to complete. The timer runs during a CGI request, which I'll be talking later on in this presentation. The recommended setting is not to have one set. When the timer pops, you'll see a pop 3 in the VB trace or V trace. The current default is 2 minutes. And when the timer does pop, the socket closes and the CGI will cancel with a SIG kill. Slide 13, please. System timeout. The system timeout specifies the wait for a client for the next request. The persistent connection ties up a worker thread unless you're using async or sockets, which we recommend. It varies on your environment, but the number of worker threads and the type of workload for SSL and non-SSL work. Now, as I said, in the next bullet said, we recommend everybody to have it. Persistent connection is particularly important for SSL environments. Well, you come think about it, when you have your doing your SSL and handshake, if you don't have persistent connection set, every time your client comes in, he has to reestablish the handshake. With persistent connection kept on, then he just does a modify handshake. What determines what else goes with factor here are the SSL timeouts. For the SSL2 timeout, the timeout is 100 seconds, and for SSL3, the timeout is 1,000 seconds. Current default for persistent timeout is 5 seconds. The action taken upon timeout is if the socket is closed. Okay, slide 14. Slide 14. We're going to talk about should we use persistent connection or not. Well, persistent connection remains open after the web server returns the response. If the response is true, then the web server will leave the connection open. Now, the client request has a keep alive connection. And if the web server is enabled for persistent connection, then that will remain true. The benefit of having this is, again, you're saving an overhead of turning down and creating a new socket for each request. It speeds up your connection. It's also a benefit, like I said earlier, with SSL sessions, where we won't remove the socket. Well, one socket will to the next. Abbreviated handshake will be done. The disadvantage of this is that it ties up the HP server worker thread for the duration of persistence. And this could be dangerous in denial of service attacks. But, again, this is more a bigger concern when we had slow input modems, but now with high-speed internet, it's not so much you don't have to set a very high value. It's something that you have to tune according to your specifications. The intended purpose of this is to speed up the links for HTML pages so the client doesn't have to wait to read and hit enter. Okay, slide 15, please. Okay, now we're going to start talking about CGIs, fast CGIs, and GWAPIs. Okay, CGI is a standard that is supported by most web services. It defines how information exchange between the web server and external programs. And the CGI programs are stored in binary subdirectories. They can be written in any language that's supported by ZOS, C++, Perl, Rex, etc. They run in a separate address space spawned by the HP server. They provide an isolation of work for the HP server. There is some cost for it, so they do take up address space, creating address space and cleaning up after each other. It does create a long code path. And The other problem is that the address space might not have the same priority as the HTTP server. By default, we recommend in our manual to have the HTTP server set up as a super user, but there's a lot of customers who don't, and I can see why. It makes sense not to have that so. So when you send off your request, it will not validate your AppSpan client directive. Slide 16, please. Fast CGI is a way to combine the advantages of a normal CGI program with some of the performance benefits that we get with OWASP. Fast CGI was written by Open Market in C, and it's an extension of a normal web server. Fast CGI allows you to start application independent of the address space and pass the request to the application from the web server to these processes. The communication is handled by the TCP/IP socket interface or by Unix by the path of the HFS or ZFS that was specified in the file system. By default, FastCGI support is disabled, and there are directives on how to enable it, and I list them in my speaker's notes. Slide 17, please. Slide 17 is GoAPI, or Go Web Server Application Program Interface. This interface is to HTTP server and allows the extension of the server-based function. It was written to customize the process as enhancing the basic authentication, to add error handling routines, and also to detect and track information that comes from a client request. Some of the bullets here on this page, it will increase storage footprint of the HTTP server. It will tie up a worker thread in the extended time, same as the CGI. The only difference is that the CPU will not run in the HTTP server, in this case of the GoAPI. So you get some benefit there. Slide 18, we're still talking about performance, so how can we increase our performance? Well, there are several ways to increase the performance, I'm going to list some of them here, is caching. Now, caching improves, depends on your application design and the behavior of your client. Okay, so the question we've got to ask ourselves is, what type of clients you have and what caching benefits? Where caching is very helpful with a static HTML page. If you're creating a lot of dynamic pages or a lot of posting, then enabling caching will not be that much of a benefit for you. HTTP server provides caching using Fricka. In Fricka, you can cache files that serve without invoking HTTP server after the first time they are served. So there are several types of caching. There is the Fricka caching, local caching, proxy caching, and then there's just the other caching, the caching that comes with ZOS and disk management. Slide 19, please. Okay, first we talk about Fricka, Fast Response Cache Accelerator. The HTTP server provides an exit code to TCP/IP. This exit code is driven by each cache request. The exit code allows things to be tracked, incoming requests, for instance. The caching will not prevent byte service. The contents will be saved just as at a TCP/IP layer. The benefits are it prevents wait cycles in running each request through the HTTP server. And the I/O require and prevents the I/O from being read off the HFS. Currently, I'm going to step down to the other bullet. The TCP/IP Fast Response allows you to protect caching objects for user IDs in Rack S. But beware, you cannot use Fricka as a substitute for authentication. Where if you are a user using %client, you always have to authenticate. The client will never be able to find the file you're looking for. Slide 20, please. Okay, Pricker is enabled with the HP server, and it's emptied when HP server ends. You can display the stats of your Pricker with the command I listed. You can set up WOM transaction class to manage the performance with Fricka parms, and there's also a Fricka log. Slide 21, please. Okay, now we're talking about monitoring our HTTP server. Okay, you can use the modify command to monitor your server and also to dynamically enable your tracing, which I'll be talking about shortly. A very useful command is use the Apple equals V stack command. Next slide, please. On slide 22, I give you an example of what the output looks like. Some of the things I want to key in here on this example is the thread running. Thread running is the total number of threads available to work. Thread running and the maximum allowed of threads are available at the same time. However, if the web server shut down any threads, the threads will equal the maximum allowed threads minus the number of threads shut down since the web server. You notice in the slide here I have a thread running 125 threads, idle threads 119, so that means I have 6 threads actively working. Okay, at the time I took this cut and paste picture. Slide 23, please. And now we're going to talk about troubleshooting. Okay, when it comes to troubleshooting, we have to understand a little about where our request is coming from and how it's coming and where it's coming across the wire. When a request comes in, they all have headers in the first two rows. Each header is separated by a character control line feed. When we reach two character control line feed, the header is done. If there is a content line header specified, then the HTTP server, using the protocol, the RFC, will assume that the next set of data is the amount of data is the data being sent. When we hit the length of the content length, then we will assume that that's the end of the data. Now, the problem is, if you send less data than the content length, you might have a hanging condition. If you send more data than the content length, you get an application error, because we're going to try to match on the content length. Okay, slide 24, please. For tracing, as I said earlier, you can enable tracing at the startup, which can tie up your HFS and your logs quite largely, or you can enable it dynamically. There are three forms of tracing that we have. There is vTrace, a vvTrace, and an mtvTrace. And they're verbose, very verbose, and much too verbose. We don't use mtvTrace very often. We do use vTrace and vvTrace. And I'll be going over the difference between, over the next few slides, the difference between a vTrace and a vvTrace. Slide 25, please. Okay, as stated, when a work comes in for troubleshooting on a standalone server, we want to try to isolate the thread to figure out what happened to the request. When we're looking at a scalable or asynchronous configuration stance server, then we want to focus more on the socket. And on the, if you're looking at the asynchronous, you're going to look at the SOBJ socket. That's the master socket that controls all the release sounds. So this slide really is geared towards more standalone, where it's saying isolate the work based on the thread ID. But when it comes to asynchronous and scalable, you want to more focus on the socket. Now, one of my colleagues, Chad, wrote a program that's available, and there's a reference number for and also URL to pull down that will parse through the V record. And in my V notes, I gave an output of what the output looks like. So what's in these V records? Slide number 26. Well, the V records contain timestamp information. It's like a breadcrumb detective that tells you where your request's been. And in the middle there, the highlighted in bold, I have it listed out, and you see the big letter V in there. Now, The first level vTrace is designed to provide a basic tracing information for all requests without a significant impact to the HTTP server performance. The fields are designed automatically parsed for this information. Now, slide number 27 goes to the parsing. And I'm not going to go through all the variables, but in my handouts, I gave a little bit more, a bigger picture of what the vRecker looks like. Number 28, please. And the event timestamps are given in the elapsed time since January 1st, 1970. They are listed as entries and exit pairs as with the elapsed time spent in each module by determining the calculation, the difference between timestamps. Now, we have acceptable wait, SSL handshake, request parsing, CGI exit, servlet exit, and request completion timeouts. Slide number 29, please. Now, if we want to get more in tune with what's happening in requests, and we just don't want to look at how much time the request came in and out, we enable vBtrace. And what the vBtrace will give us, it begins with the request headers. And that will tell us stuff like cookies, authorization, what was the content length, and etc. Slide 30, please. Slide 30, I gave you a little example of what a vBtrace lookout looks like. As you notice in the middle there, there's a threads get, and that's how you tell what your URL of your request that came in. Slide 31, please. Now, as I said with vBtrace, we have response headers. And with response headers, it gives you information about the request. As you see in the handout on this slide here, it gives us the content length, the last time it was modified, the type of server that sent it, and you can also get cookie information. It just happened that on this request I sent, I wasn't passing any cookie information. So it's not displayed here. So it gives you an idea of what the response header looks like. And this is pretty valuable information for us for troubleshooting, because if you're troubleshooting a request that's coming to the plugin to the web server, you want to know what the request looks like. And that's very important. Next slide, please. Okay, some more on troubleshooting. When you're troubleshooting a CGI, there are many issues that can help us decide the vBtrace. You might need a customer to enable some type of print line statements in the program itself. Also, with a CGI spawns into a different address space. So that would be another reason for having print line statements, so we could see what's happening at our address space. Also, if you're going to the plugin, it's good to understand what the plugin is doing in a request. So in here, I listed what you have to change in the plugin config XML file to enable plugin trace. And again, the plugin trace can be enabled dynamically also. It all depends what you have set for your refresh interval in your plugin. By default, it's 60 seconds, but you can change that to 30 or 10. It's up to your specification, whatever you feel fit for your need. But if you have it set for the default for 60 seconds, well, then after you made an update to the plugin XML file, then a minute later, the tracing will be enabled. Slide number 33, please. 33, there is information on documentation for the HTTP server. I list URL for publication, other handouts, and in white paper on async per socket. And this completes the presentation.
At this time, we'll conclude the presentation. We hope the information presented today has been valuable to you. We appreciate your participation. We hope you will join us for future presentations, which will be announced on the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site. Remember, a replay of today's presentation will also be available on this site in the next day or two. Thanks very much for joining us today, and thank you, Zygmunt, for presenting today.
Thank you. Everyone have a nice day.